little by little, year after year. Hadia had given up any expectations of Amar, had tried to encounter him only as he was. "What is it you want, Amira?" she had asked her. They were both dressed entirely in black flowing abayas, so her face looked even more pale and vulnerable. Amira did not answer right away. She bit her lip and looked to the mosque entrance, where people had begun to exit and head to their cars. "I know Amar is good. I know Amar wants to be good. But I want to be with someone who is a harmonious fit. Do you think his heart is open to the life we have?"
"If that is what you want, my brother cannot be that for you. He cannot be that for any of us." For years afterward, that would be the line she returned to, asking herself why she had replied the way she had. But in that moment, she had not wanted to deceive Amira, had not wanted to draw her any closer to the same chaos they were all suffering from.
"Thank you," Amira said at last. "I've been so conflicted. I think this will make it easier."
Again she held Amira, and Amira let herself cry. Before Hadia turned to leave, Amira stopped her and hesitated before saying,
"I really do love him. If he wanted this life, even if it was a struggle for him to live it, I would stand by him."
Hadia did not know what to say. She told her so.
"I just wanted someone to know that. I just needed to say it to someone out loud."
He was waiting for the seasickness to pass. Then he would return to the wedding, be again the brother of the bride. He had missed more than he had attended. And if he did not go back now, Hadia would notice. They had to stand together for the family photograph. They had to say goodbye to Hadia. And he did want to speak to his father. Hours earlier, when he watched his father stand in the blue light of the backyard, Amar told himself he was still angry. But in his heart, he knew he was like a child who refused to allow himself the one thing he wanted, to drop the fuss and go to him. Amira had once told him he would feel something other than anger, and he had not believed her. He thought his anger would never be extinguished. Now he had exhausted his anger, exhausted himself, and found that what was left, what was inexhaustible, was longing and regret, each feeling fueling the other. Sometimes, Amar thought, he could blame the distance between himself and his father on his own lack of steadfast belief in God. He could not claim to know God existed with any certainty. But there was love in his heart for the men and the women from the stories, the people of the Holy Book. Love for the man whose name Mama traced on his forehead, or pointed out on the moon, whose name was evoked in the Nare. And even if, Amar said to himself, he did not believe, still, his mouth opened to respond to the call. What was this love, he wondered, as he twisted open and closed the cap of the bottle. And why was it still such a part of him, when all that could go had gone? First the rituals went, and were replaced by guilt. And then the guilt went, and soon his belief faltered, before vanishing almost entirely too. Belief in hellfire, and the narrow bridge one had to cross to reach heaven, as thin as a hair, as sharp as the blade of a knife. But the love for them remained, the prophets and the imams, the characters from the stories he heard as a child, balanced on Mama's knee, curling her hair around his finger, and it was a love, untarnished by the resentment of his father, that had so afflicted everything else. The whiskey burned when swallowed. He sank his face into his hands and hoped to feel steady soon. Every minute he remained outside was a minute that sped toward the end of his sister's wedding. He took a deep breath. Tonight had threatened all the work he had done. Telling himself he did not believe, and therefore did not belong, that his belonging depended on belief. If only he could tell his father, "Look, I have kept this. I have held on to it. I open my mouth to criticize someone, but then I close it," thinking of how the prophet did not even tell the little girl to eat fewer dates when her mother asked him to, knowing he too shared her habit. "My heart clenches at the thought of 12 brothers leading their youngest to a ditch, snatching from him his father's gift, that colorful coat. And I think, and think again of that child, climbing onto his grandfather's back while he knelt in prayer, oblivious to everyone who was watching and waiting for his grandfather to set the standard for them all." 3. Vases of orchids had been gathered onto one table. The staff was busy clearing clutter from the others. Final families waited to be photographed. Close family friends waited for the ruksati. Layla sat alone at a far table and watched the hall blur before her. Either exhaustion or tears. The lights of the chandelier becoming geometric shapes that twinkled. "Mama?" Huda said, snapping the hall back into focus. Huda took a seat by her and leaned in to look at Layla's face. "Ma," Huda said again, her voice more loving. "What have I done?" Huda sighed. Huda, the daughter she counted on to speak her mind and take a balanced stance, neither comforted Layla nor criticized her. "Was he all right?"
"Amar will always be Amar, Ma. There's nothing we can do for him."
She had tried, hadn't she? She had tried her best. Her intentions were good, were they not? It was hardly a comfort now. Intentions shrank next to actions. Actions took on their own momentum. Amar had not come back into the hall after his outburst. She had underestimated his care for Amira Ali, then and now. She had put too much faith in the passage of time. When Amar was little, she stayed up late after putting him to bed, secretly read books for an answer on how to parent him. She sat through every parent-teacher meeting, mortified at how his teacher spoke slowly, assuming Layla could not understand. She tried to become the mother he needed, preparing herself, enlarging herself, educating herself, only to have let him down the way she had. "Does she love him?" she remembered Rafiq asking, as though he believed Amira's love could change the outcome for their son. Layla had not believed, not in the girl's love, nor in her son's ability to win over Amira's family. She could say nothing when Amar accused her tonight, could do nothing but sit and wonder just how the limits to her belief in her son had so dangerously destroyed his possibilities. Now she deserved any outcome. No longer could she say this was a test from God to prove her faith. It was that. But it was also her own actions returning to haunt her. Rafiq walked over to her. He had been managing last-minute jobs. Huda left them as soon as he approached. "Time for our photograph soon," he told her. Danny was on the stage now, smiling brightly, Hadia's oldest friend, who Layla loved cooking for, who still came over any time the two of them were back home for a visit. What's happened, Leila?
He asked, alarmed.
Again, the lights became a blur of moving shapes. She blinked until it returned to normal. Rafiq took a seat by her.
Will you find Amar? She asked. Will you call him back for the photo? He won't come if I go.
Rafiq sighed. There was no time for him to ask why. She had been foolish. She had asked Rafiq to not speak to Amar all night, thinking Rafiq was to blame for their troubles with Amar. Now she knew better. A saying her father had taught her when she was very young came back to her as Rafiq stood to go and bring back their son.
Be careful who you point your blame at, Leila. And remember that any time you point your finger to accuse someone, there are three fingers beneath it, curled to point right back at you.
There was a tap on his shoulder, and he looked up to see it was his father. Amar was still in the courtyard, sitting on the lone bench. His first thought was that he could get away with it, trick his father into thinking he was composed, that the edges of the world had not begun to spin. He opened his mouth to say something, and then closed it. His father took a seat. The night was cold. The gray clouds that had raced across the sky when he sat by Amira were gone. His father handed him a glass of water, and Amar gulped it down. He thanked him. He had not realized he had been so thirsty.
Baba, he said, just to break the long silence.
But he sounded like a child pleading, a break between the two syllables. He had not called him Baba in years. There was a day when he decided this was how he would punish his father, that he would not only withhold affection and respect, but he would also keep from calling him father. The light of the lamp at the far end of the courtyard doubled and swayed. His father placed a hand on his shoulder and left it there. His hand was warm, and Amar could feel it through the fabric of his shirt. He did not move, just in case his father's hand slipped. How did Amar get here, and was this really happening? How long ago had Amira been sitting in the courtyard across from him? She wore a delicate gold necklace. She had beautiful lips. She laughed the same way she had always laughed. Some things never changed, and those things were a comfort and a way to mark all the rest that had.
Do you remember the story of Imam Hussein as a child, and how he climbed onto the Prophet's back during prayer?
Amar asked.
Of course. Why do you think we were told that?
Baba looked up, and then down at his feet. He shrugged.
To show us how much he loved his grandson, Baba said. But what if it was meant to show us more? What if we were meant to look closer?
There was a pause.
I don't know, Amar. I never think about things the way you do.
I do think about things. He meant it as a statement, but it sounded like a question.
I know you do.
Is it enough?
I pray it will be.
Baba cupped his arms in his lap, then lay them open.
I just wanted you to know that I remember that.
His father nodded. Was Amar crying? Is that why his shoulders were shaking? Is that why Baba's hand was moving up and down his back and he was pulling Amar close to his body? And Amar knew that scent. They are driving down a long street lined with lots of trees, and it is exciting to be so close to the wide window. And Baba leans across him to turn the knob of the window until the wind slaps his face, and that is the scent. Now his father was saying something to him, and Amar focused on his words until he heard that he was saying, "It's okay, it's okay, it's okay." He was repeating it like a prayer. How long had he wanted this without knowing it was what he wanted? "It's okay," his father said, his heavy hand moving up and down his back, and Amar knew that he was crying. He nodded into Baba's arm and tried to close his eyes, but that made the spinning worse. Then he remembered there was a wedding, and the wedding was Hadia's, and that it was why he had come. "I have to go back," he thought. But he must have spoken it aloud, because his father shook his head. "I have to go back. But you can't come back inside, Amar," Baba said. He had fucked up. It was apparent to anyone who looked at him. He nodded. "Will you go back now?" Amar asked.
"Not yet."
"What are you waiting for?" Baba did not answer him.
"Why do you do that?" Amar asked. "Do what?"
Amar touched his hand to his eyebrow and ran his fingers along the length of it, then back up again.
"I didn't realize I did it."
"You always have."
"I suppose I'm just thinking."
"I always thought it meant you were so angry you wouldn't speak." Baba shook his head. He looked up at the sky again, as if he were searching for something there.
"It's okay," Amar said, repeating what had just been said to him.
And he touched his hand against his father's shoulder, because even in the blue dark, it looked like Baba was the one who was now about to cry.
"Was your father a good father?" Amar asked.
He did not know why he asked it. Baba was quiet. Then he said,
"He was very strict. I was very afraid of him. He died when I was a boy, so I never knew if it would be different between us when I grew older. If he would be another way with me."
"I look like him," Amar said.
"You do."
Baba smiled a little.
"Will you leave soon?"
"In a minute."
Both of them looked at the moon in the sky and the tiny stars. Amar shivered.
"I don't think I will make it," Amar said.
"I'm sorry."
"Of course you can't come back inside, Amar. You can hardly sit up."
"No. I mean, to the other place. The next place. I don't think I'll make it. I don't think you'll find me there."
He had left the path. His parents had given him a map and directions, and he had abandoned it all. Now his heart was so ink dark, he could be lost and not know it, and not care, and never know how to find his way back.
"Listen to me." Baba held onto his arm. "You could never be more wrong, Amar. We taught you one way, but there could be others. We don't even know. Even we can only hope. How many names are there for God?"
99. He knew all of this by heart. Didn't that count for something?
"And are they all the same kind of name?"
"No."
"Some contradict each other, remember? Didn't you just say to me, what if this is meant to show us more? What if we are meant to look closer?"
Amar nodded. Wind rustled the leaves. He sniffled and wiped his nose on his shirt sleeve.
"We will wait until you are allowed in," Baba said, as if to himself. "I will wait."
Baba pointed at the sky, and Amar looked, past the stars and past the lighter patch of the Milky Way, past the moon, and maybe God was there, and maybe God wasn't. But when Baba said to him,
"I don't think he created us just to leave some of us behind,"
Amar believed him. Amar wanted to. Baba opened his wallet.
"Take this," he said,
and he folded a bunch of notes into his hand. He did not count them. The bills were layered and layered.
"Will you have a place to sleep tonight? Is where you were near where we are now? Can you go back with ease?"
Amar wasn't sure, but he nodded.
"You have enough for a taxi?"
Baba asked. He nodded again. Baba added another note and pressed it into his palm, closed Amar's fingers around it, and said,
"A little more, in case it is farther. This should be enough."
Amar leaned his head against Baba's arm. Baba stopped speaking. It felt as if neither of them were breathing. Then he patted Amar's hair down, like Mama would do for him when he was younger.
"It will be all right, inshallah. But I have to go back inside now."
Amar felt as he did as a boy, when Baba dropped him off at school and before he closed the door, Baba reminded him, "You have to stay here the whole day. You cannot call Mama and you cannot call your sisters. I have to go, but you have to stay."
"You will be all right? You feel all right?"
Amar nodded.
It's just the drink?"
Baba whispered it. Amar nodded.
"Qasam?"
Baba asked him. "Qasam." They sat together. Then he blinked, and Baba was gone. One night, when he was very little, before Huda began to wear her scarf, Mama told them what it would be like in heaven. "Everyone will be born again with the faces they had in their youth. Mothers and daughters will look like sisters. Fathers and sons will look like brothers. In heaven, no one will be old. No one will be tired. There will be nothing to want. There will be rivers of water and rivers of milk and honey. There will be homes made entirely of jewels, emeralds and rubies and sapphires. But just before we make it to heaven," she said, "there will come the judgment day." Amar's heart was thumping in his chest. Mama said, "There is an angel whose entire existence is spent waiting for that moment to blow into the shell and wake every soul that has ever lived. That day, everyone will rise to fend for themselves. Everyone will forget that in life they had a mother, a daughter, a friend. They will only worry for their own souls, if their soul will make it to the other side. We will wait so long to be called forward. It will feel like lifetimes pass before it is our turn. And then, when the long line has dwindled and we stand to be judged, each body part will speak against us to say what we did in our life, if we had gone toward evil or stayed away from it. And the angels that sat on our shoulders will unroll their scrolls and read out our actions for God to decide our fate." Amar had been frightened. He pictured a stampede of people. He pictured his hands speaking against him to say that he had shoved Huda. He pictured his tongue speaking against him to say he had told lies, But the thought of looking the same age as his parents frightened him the most. How would he recognize them? What would it be like if they all rose and no one cared for each other? Mama continued speaking about the bridge that would be as thin as a hair and sharp as a blade. And it was Baba who noticed the look on his face.
What's wrong? Baba asked him.
We won't care about each other? He asked.
Ami, no one will be caring about anybody, Mama said. Not until everyone has made it to the other side, to heaven.
How will we know what our faces in heaven will be? How will we reunite if everyone who has ever existed is there?
He had begun to cry. He did not want this life to end. He did not care for houses made of rubies or rivers of honey, not if the sound of the shell separated him from them.
We will find you, Baba had said. Don't worry about that. Just worry about your deeds. I could find you anywhere.
Soon the spinning would steady. He would find his way to a place where he could rest until morning. Maybe there was no God. But maybe the God of his parents was there, watching him tonight as on all nights. And if he was there, he had revealed 99 names for them to understand him. There was the Avenger, the Firm, but there was also the Forgiving, the Patient. To read any surah in the Quran, one first had to read of God's mercy and compassion. Almost every single chapter began with that line. The Prophet was the leader of the entire Ummah, his every action an example. But when his grandson climbed his back, he had bent the rules. And what if it had been because it was more important to protect a child from pain than to be unwavering in principle? Maybe it was the exceptions we made for one another that brought God more pride than when we stood firm. Maybe his heart opened when his creations opened their hearts to one another. And maybe that is why the boy was switched with the ram. So a father would not have to choose between his boy and his belief. There was another way. Amar was sure of it. He wanted them to find it together. The photographer was scheduled to leave, but Leila asked him to wait just a moment longer. Her husband and son were about to come back.
Our family photo, she said to him. It's more important than the others.
The photographer looked at Leila as if he could not decide if he was irritated by her or felt sorry for her. But he agreed, and Leila thanked him with her hand on her heart. Her headache had worsened. She held her hand over her mouth each time she thought she was about to cry. Rafiq had disappeared at least half an hour earlier. A tightness coiled in her chest had not loosened, and she looked forward to the end of the night, when she could sit on her bed, take off her heels and jewelry and heavy sari, and just close her eyes. Rafiq approached. Amar was not with him. Still, she felt a wave of relief, stepped quickly toward him, and when they were face to face, she reached out to touch her hand against his cheek.
You are cold, she said.
Did you find him?
No.
You looked?
Yes.
Everywhere?
She looked behind him, down the corridor Rafiq had come from.
Leila.
She began to walk past him, but before she could go far, he reached out and gently placed a hand on her shoulder. She glanced around. Guests passed, not noticing. He looked at her tenderly, until she stilled, and then he let go. The rims of his eyes were red. There were times in their marriage when he had horrified her by the way he could yell at their children. But Leila had never felt afraid of him. What he sometimes unleashed on them, he always held back from her. When he spoke now, he did so softly.
"We have to go back to Hadia. It's time to give her away."
They turned to look back at the main hall. A young child was asleep on her father's shoulder, her little feet bare, her mother following with her shoes hooked on curled fingers. They had their whole lives ahead of them. They moved through a world where anything was possible and did not even know it to be grateful for it. One day the possibilities of their life would narrow until there was only one outcome to a night like this. Leila stared at the family until they were on the other side of the glass door. Rafiq touched her back. She knew what he was asking of her: to give up hope of finding Amar.
"I can't do this," she said.
"You can," he said, and she looked up at him. "You have been so strong and patient for years."
He guided her back as if she had forgotten the way. Before they stepped into the main hall, she spoke.
"I made a terrible mistake."
It was a relief just to say it.
"What do you mean?"
"You were right, all those years ago. I should never have gone to Seema."
"Why are you thinking of this now?"
"He knows."
Rafiq stopped walking.
"If he left tonight, if he's leaving, it is because of me." "They spoke," she told him.
"Let me go look for him. Let me apologize."
Her husband had aged in a night. He did not say anything, but he looked from where Hadia stood on the stage waiting to Leila, then back down the corridor. Amar was back there. He had found him.
"Leila, we did then what we thought was right, and now we have to do what is required of us."
He gestured to Hadia, who lifted her hand up to get their attention. The photographer was looking at them too. Rafiq was right. Leila looked over at her husband's profile as they walked. She could not read the look on his face. He hid what he felt from everyone, and it had the opposite effect he intended. It only made her care more. Rafiq extended his hand to help her up the stairs. Her children would all leave, but Rafiq would remain a blessing in her life, the center, the constant, the only one who truly bore the weight of this moment the way she did. She thanked the photographer, and he stood with his camera to position them. He did not ask any questions. The weakness she had felt after Rafiq returned without Amar left her when she saw a panicked look on Hadia's face.
"No," Hadia said. "Absolutely not. We wait for him."
"There is no time," Leila said.
Tariq did not know what to do. He looked from Leila to Hadia, then at his lap.
"We will wait for him,"
Hadia said, shaking her head. Her tikka shifted from the center of her forehead. Huda stepped forward to fix it. Hadia moved her hand away.
"He's not coming, Hadia," Leila told her, her voice stern.
Comforting Hadia distracted Leila from her own grief. She would mourn tomorrow, alone, with no one there to witness. But tonight, she would be strong for her daughter. Hadia's eyes filled at once, that sheen before crying.
"You knew about this and didn't tell me?" she asked Huda.
"He told me he was going to come back the last time we spoke," Huda said.
"Baba, will you go look for him?"
Hadia asked.
"He's gone, John," Your mother is right. We have to continue.
Tariq reached for Hadia's hand, and he kissed her knuckle, then held it. In that instant, Leila saw Hadia give up. A vacant look came over her face. The photographer instructed Huda to stand by Rafiq. Leila took her place at the other side of Huda. She heard the photographer say, "Smile."
"Hadia, look at me," the photographer said. "That's better."
"Perfect," the photographer said.
"I got the one."
Leila knew she would never replace the photograph above the mantle. Years ago, when she had opened Amar's box and seen photographs of him that Amira Ali must have taken, she had been surprised, not only by their existence, but also by how unguarded he was, how happy he looked in a way she'd never seen. Back then, Leila remembered thinking that humiliation was a deeper wound than heartache. She had wanted to protect them all from it. Now, as they stood beneath the spotlight on the stage, before the remaining guests, who surely must be whispering to one another, "Where is their son? Does he not care for them enough to stay for the family photograph?" She knew better. Knew that it did not matter what anyone thought if her own heart were not at peace. Only after her worst fears were confirmed did she realize there had been no use in letting her fears determine her decisions. She was finally free of them. She finally knew. She wanted Amar there, in any state, under any circumstance, regardless of what anyone had to say about it. Now her son was gone again. He would be the test of her life. She would have to remain graceful and patient and without despair when thinking of him. It would not be easy, but it was not impossible. What was impossible was the wish, the prayer that rose in her again. "Just one more moment. Just give us one more." But maybe her heart would never be satisfied. Maybe it was ever enlarging in its want for more. Because she knew that if she were granted one more moment, then another one was what she would ask for. She could live around her son for 100 years, and even then, when it was time for them to part, she would think, "But it has been too brief as stepping from the shade out into the sun," and she would wish to hear again his knock at the door, look up from the duas she was reading to that simple sight of him leaning against the door frame, and he would ask if he could come and lie in her lap. And she would not even have to say yes. He would already know. In her purse was the small package from Amar. She needed to open it alone. It could not wait. It could contain a clue. Huda walked with her to the restroom, holding the trail of her heavy dress. "What are you hiding from me?" Hadia asked her. "Can you at least try to enjoy the rest of your night?" Hadia looked at her coldly. Huda sighed. The hall was half empty and quieter now. "He fought with Mama. It was about Amira." "What has Mama got to do with Amira?" "Mama had known. She had told Seema Aunty. He spoke with Amira tonight and was devastated that Mama didn't believe in him. Or that if it had been one of us, she would have acted differently." Hadia told Huda she needed a moment alone, and stepped into the golden bathroom light. Her hands shook as she reached into her purse. Gently, so as not to tear the wrapping, she tugged at the tape. She drew her breath in so sharply it startled her. It was her watch, her Baba's watch, her Dada's watch. Not a single scratch. The face spotless as if polished, the tick announcing each new second. She wondered If it had always been his plan to return what was not his and then disappear again. She was shaking. She leaned against the door. She turned the wrapping paper over, then again, held it up to the light. But there was no note. This, more than anything else, upset her.
Does the watch always go to father's?
Amar asked the strangest questions, the ones none of them thought to.
You mean sons?
She had taken from him what in another life would have belonged to him by birth. She had worked hard to be as valuable as any son. Her betrayals to her brother were scattered throughout the years. But perhaps being given this watch was the culmination of them all. No one could see it on her wrist and deny what it meant. Hadia opened the door and let Huda in. She held up the watch. Huda's mouth opened in shock.
Will you tell Mama Baba?
She shook her head. I'll say I found it when packing to move. Huda nodded and said,
It will be as if he never took it.
Hadia wrapped it again and placed it back in her purse. She did not even want it anymore.
Do you think this means he was saying goodbye?
Hadia's voice was small. Huda did not answer. Without a note, she could only guess at what he was trying to tell her.
Here, take what is yours, what has always been, what will always be. I am no contender.
Giving it back was both admitting he had taken it and attempting to apologize. Hadia had behaved in ways that she not only could not take back, but also could never admit to. She never told Amar what it was like for her to look up at his test all those years ago, to see his handwriting that was so like hers, the sight of it threatened her. Or that she had hinted about Amira and Amar's affair to Mama. She did not even know why she had done it. Maybe to distract Mama from Hadia's decision, still recent then, to step toward Tariq. Maybe just to disturb the golden lens through which Mama regarded her cherished son. And she never told Amar that she and Amira had spoken years ago. Hadia had power in that moment, and she had done nothing with it for her brother, had made no attempt to steer Amira back to him.
Don't tell, he'd ask her.
And what did she do but tell and tell? And the only thing she kept from telling was her part. All Amar had done to her was take this dumb watch. He had not even reaped the benefit of his betrayal the way that she had and would continue to be the child her parents could count on, to be the one they were proud of. Any hurt he caused, any disappointment he brought, it only amplified her place in their parents' life and their love for her. In the hall, Baba recited the Adhan for the Rukhsati, though it was the brother's duty to. It was this moment she had wanted Amar to come back for. She hugged everyone from the community who had stayed to say goodbye, then her friends. She hugged her sister tight and her mother for so long. She knew there was no point in looking around, but still, she looked for him. Just the empty stage and tables and flower vases lined up on one.
What will I do without you?
Baba said to her when she said goodbye to him. She remembered watching brides cry during their Rukhsati as a child, and fearing her time would come and she would not shed a tear. Now she cried like a little girl. Her shoulders shook, and Baba's hug steadied her. The overwhelming feeling now, as it was almost over, was that she wanted only to love them more, to love them better.
I'll be back, she said. I will not leave you two,
She took Tariq's hand. Mama held the Quran above them as they stepped out into the night. Everyone clapped behind them. The air was cool. Their decorated car was waiting. Tariq stopped walking. He pointed up at the sky. She looked and saw nothing. Just some stars. She turned to Tariq's profile.
"Keep looking," he whispered.
Then there was a hiss and a streak of smoke in the sky, and Tariq pulled her close and kissed the top of her head, said, "Surprise," just as the firework boomed and the sound drummed in her whole body and the glitter descended and disappeared. Hadia had told Tariq about the first time she ever saw fireworks, how even now, any time she saw them, it made her feel the way she had that night, full of wonder and excitement about all the sights life could offer her. There was another, and another, and another. Her heart was beating very fast. All their faces were lit up by colors, blue and red and green. Once she had sat at the dinner table and overheard a fight between Ammar and Baba. Baba's voice had shaken the beads of the chandelier. In that moment, Hadia had wished for exactly this, exactly what was being granted to her now. A new family, her own. A new window from which to look out and think, "I'm home." A firework that reminded her of a rocket zipped up in coils and exploded in coils. She had seen it somewhere before. Ammar was laughing in that memory. When the chandelier shook, this had been her wish. Now everything she had ever wanted had become hers. And where was her brother? And was he close enough to look up and see the rocket firework that somehow she knew he liked? She tightened her hold on her husband's hand. She loved him. She would start her own family with him. The last of the fireworks dissolved. The sky was all smoke. Had she reached out for Ammar's hand beneath the dining table that night? Had she done as much? She could not remember now.
Part 4 1 When you were born, you did not cry. Your face turned blue, almost purple, and the relief I had felt at seeing you, at realizing you had entered the world, plummeted when the doctors and nurses huddled around your body, separating me from you. Your mother raised her head to ask if everything was all right. Her voice was pitched high, but her expression oddly calm, as though she had foreseen such complications. The doctor did not reply. A nurse's sneaker squeaked against the linoleum floor. The clock ticked. Only then did I realize you had not marked your entrance into this world with the same screams as your sisters before you. That is how you came into our lives. I held my breath. I did not move. I stood between your mother and the doctor examining you, unable to look at either, unable to do anything but focus on my gloved hands held out helplessly in front of me. Because you could not breathe easily, I could not either. Your mother regards it as our miracle from God that soon your lungs were emptied and you began gasping for air, crying even. And I too thanked God, knelt in sajda shukr once the nurses and doctors took you and gave us privacy. But when my forehead touched the cold floor, I wondered if it had been an omen, though I have not told Layla this. I have not told anyone. Now I am watching the clouds quicken across the sky from my hospital window, cities away from the one I swear I was just in, pulling tight the gloves over my wrists, slipping my arms through a paper gown, going to Layla to be beside her. In that room, I was a young father. I had cut the cord connecting you, my third child, to my wife. You were a boy. It was my one thought that instant before the doctor took you. I was a father to a son. It has been 30-some years, but it has felt like blinking. I am awake in one room, I close my eyes, and by the time I have opened them again, I am here. I am insisting on helping myself when Hadia steps forward to peel back the foil wrapper of applesauce. Bas, I say to her, holding up my hand. This changes nothing. She is not convinced. She raises her eyebrows like she does when she says, okay, Baba. A bad habit of stretching out the okay. But instead of saying it, she bites her tongue. And though this is the respect I have wanted, it now makes me uneasy. Her beeper buzzes, and she sighs, glances at it, and says she will leave me in a minute. And soon after, a nurse will take me for an MRI. This is my first time seeing my daughter at work. She is professional. Her voice, when speaking to other staff members, is commanding. She wears a spotless white coat that seems big on her frame. Her stethoscope is turquoise, curled and tucked into a pocket where our last name is stitched in blue thread. Recently, I had begun to feel a headache so blinding I could no longer ignore it. And though I told Hadia all was fine, Layla must have described enough symptoms that they alarmed her. How I became disoriented when I stood, how I waited a moment to take a step, afraid I would lose my balance. Hadia told us to drive to the hospital where she worked, so her colleague could admit me and arrange for some tests. She assured me I would be in good hands, that she trusted the staff here, that the neurologist was one of the best in the state. And that way Layla could stay with Hadia and help with our grandkids, and they could easily visit. At this, I relented. I have been treated well, which is a relief to me, not necessarily because of the comfort their generosity provides me, but because it has given me a sense of how Hadia treats the people around her, and how she is regarded and respected in return. You must be Hadia's father, some say, when they approach with their plastic water cups and blood pressure machines. And they speak kindly of her qualities, or tell me that I have done well in raising her. Will you bring them tonight? I ask, when she stands to her feet. We'll see, Baba. Abbas has soccer practice. First, let's concentrate on getting the tests done. I sink back into the uncomfortable bed. But that reminds me, she says, and pulls pieces of folded paper from her pocket and hands them to me. I hold on to them, but do not look down at them. I want to save them until I am alone again. I want to ask her if I can go home after the MRI, but I know what she will tell me, how they are monitoring my blood pressure, which is too high. How they want to get to the bottom of the lack of balance, that it is good for me to be here until then, and that I should trust her. She is stern when she speaks with me about all this, but gentle, using a voice I have not encountered. Perhaps she is taking full advantage of this shift, and I wonder if I would not feel as uncomfortable had I seen my own parents grow older, had I been able to care for them. And find there is no shame in the matter. If I can't get away between patients, I'll be back with the results of the MRI, she says. She smiles at me. I am so easily moved these days that I have to steady myself at the sight of her. You would be amazed to see her now, how she has matured, how she carries herself with confidence, how an entire streak of her hair has turned gray, and how it suits her. She holds my hand for a minute and kisses its knuckle before letting go, a gesture that is intended to be loving, but I feel less love and more nervous, wondering what her fears might be. When she is gone, the sounds of the hospital return, my monitor reminding me of the beating of my own heart, the rustle of the rough blanket against my papery gown, the nurses talking together in the hallway, the sound of wheelchairs or walkers making their way across the tile. It is when I am alone that I think of you again. I open the card from Abbas and Tahira that I saved for this very moment. We love you, Nana. Get well soon. Written in Abbas's chicken scratch. The exact kind of handwriting I critiqued you for when you were his age. Tahira has drawn me butterflies surrounding a house on a hill. Abbas is 7. Tahira only 4. They have enlarged my life in a way I could not have anticipated and cannot fully express. I have no duty toward them except loving them, and because of this, I am only loved in return. I am so unwilling to hurt them in even the slightest way that I spoil them instead. Hadia does not trust me to be alone with them before dinner. The 3 of us giggle and deny any chocolate consumed, even as Tahira's teeth and fingers give us away. Perhaps, if we met again now, you would not recognize me. I am calmer. I rarely anger. Perhaps you would also wonder, after years of silence and the years before in which we hardly spoke, why I now have so much I want to say. Perhaps you would even feel it is too late, that it does not matter what I have to say, because it would change nothing for you, for us. But, Amar, what if I told you that lately I find myself driving through familiar streets, unaware of how much time has passed since I left home, until it occurs to me that these were the streets I drove to drop you off at school, or the route to our barber shop that has long since closed down. At 4 in the morning, if I wake alone, I walk until I am at the threshold of your old bedroom, looking out at the barely illuminated folds of the comforter on your bed, the walls so bare now, your room almost entirely stripped of any trace of you, each item packed away in boxes and put in your closet, waiting for another decade to pass before we muster the energy to try and take another look. And it is in these moments that the fabric of my life reveals itself to be an illusion, thinking that I am fine, we all are, that we could grow around your loss, like a tree that bends around a barrier or wound, that I do not need to see you again, that the reality of our life as it is now is the best that we could have done and the best we could have hoped for. Until one Sunday, I am parked at your old elementary school, looking out at the empty blue picnic tables. Or late, when no one is looking, I crumple and toss an old test of yours in my wastebasket, only to go back for it, uncrease it, fold it gently, and place it back at the very bottom of my drawer. In those moments, no argument I have used to delude myself can comfort me. You may be unwilling to hear me. You may not understand, but please, listen. I have told you to listen many times before, I know, but I have never asked you. I am asking now. The first 2 nights after you were born, you were kept in the neonatal ward,